From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Now, if you were to find yourself strolling around Queen's Gate in London on a Sunday morning, the chances are you'd stumble across St. Augustine's. It's an enormous neo-Gothic church. And were you to go in, you might find Reverend Paul Cowley at the altar, dressed in the traditional Anglican cassock, surplice and stole, and he'll be performing the complex rituals of a 34-page Anglican High Mass. Now, that all sounds well and good until you realise there's something about him that seems, well, unexpected. His face looks kind of like it's lived some hard years, and he looks tougher than your typical priest. A lot tougher, in fact. And that's because he's an ex-army man, a former personal trainer, and an ex-offender. He's done time in prison.
And this is where we start our conversation with Paul, explaining how, at 15 years of age, he found himself behind bars.
Born in the north of England, or Manchester, so a pretty rough area, born in Salford. No siblings, just my mum and dad. They were both functioning alcoholics, so some days were good, some days were bad. They were involved in all sorts of things, really, but I grew up with my mum and dad drinking a lot, in debt. We moved quite a lot. That had an effect on me as a kid, schooling. And the last school I went to was a Manchester comprehensive, and it was awful. And I was bullied there. So I didn't go. So I ended up being expelled for truancy. And then that I left home at the same time. I got involved in an argument with my mum and dad, and my dad threw me out. And I thought, goodness me, what's outside was probably better than what I'd been doing inside. And I got involved with a gang. I moved into a squat. They took me under their wing, which was great. They helped me and then really moved me into petty theft and crime. I was never an angel, that's for sure, but I started to steal, which I'm not proud of, from houses at first, and then shops, and then factories, and then warehouses, and cars and bikes. And we would pool all this stuff. We'd all steal bits and pieces and then bring it to the house, and then that would be dispersed and money would be brought in. Then that's how I'd earn money, but I wasn't very good at it. I constantly got caught. I was always the last one coming out of whatever it was we were breaking into, where the policeman grabbed me.
Right, so you weren't very good at this.
I weren't very good, no.
And so was it the cumulative nature of this that saw you end up behind bars?
It was. I just didn't take any notice. Magistrates court, bound over to keep the peace, fines, probation. I didn't do any of that. And I remember a magistrate saying, "You're not listening to anything we're trying to do. You're going to prison, son." And that was it.
Did that help you listen? How long were you there for?
I was in Risley for about a year. It was a Borstal detention centre at the time. Well, less than a year. A magistrate can only give a year's sentence. So I did just over 6 months, really. Yeah, it did, Simon, actually. It was a horrendous place. So it did teach me a lesson. If it did, it taught me I do not want to go back to that sort of place again.
Did you get any sense of rehabilitation while you were in prison?
No, nothing. Absolutely nothing. No. Mm. I learned how to clean toilets and clean floors. That was about it. That was my rehabilitation.
Well, those are valuable life skills.
They really are now. Absolutely.
So you came out of prison and you joined the army.
I joined the army.
Why?
When I came out of prison, I wanted to get my act together, so I got a driving job. I got a one-room apartment. I was working in a bar at night trying to hold myself together. And while I was doing that, it was great, but it was boring. And then I saw a poster for the British Army, and when I looked back, it was fantastic marketing. It was two soldiers in camouflage uniform. It was a backdrop of mountains. There was snow on the top, blue sky. It was sunny. They were smiling, and they were also skiing. And it said underneath, "Do you want a life of adventure? Join the army." And that was it for me. I was in.
Calculated to appeal to a boy from the north of England.
Absolutely.
A sunny poster.
Absolutely.
So this is a positive experience for you. How did that shape your life?
The army was really positive, and I'm still very pro the army, because it did save my life. It gave me a family. It brought out some leadership skills in me. It fed me. It watered me. It clothed me. It enabled me to travel, and it developed me as a man. It taught me about leadership. Taught me about character. Taught me about responsibility and discipline. So yeah, it really shaped my life.
Eventually, Paul left the army and entered the fitness industry, running a couple of health clubs in London and working as a personal trainer. And it was around this time that he also ended up at a church hearing about Jesus, and rather unexpectedly, liking what he was hearing. It all started with a friend inviting him to something called an Alpha course.
When I heard the word course, you know, 16.5 years in the military, that's all you do, courses. So I thought, what's the course on? And he said, it's on God. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I got invited to a course called Alpha, which is really just, now I know what it was. It was an introduction to the Christian faith, all the bits of the Bible broken down, and you had something to eat in the chat and that sort of stuff.
You got drawn in, right? You're now a minister.
I got drawn in. I suppose I got more than I bargained for. I did get drawn in, actually. I found on this course, I just found the character of Jesus just really interesting. You know, whether you believe he's the Son of God or not is another question. But I found the character really fascinating. I found out that he was a strong man. I found out that he worked with the poor, the lost, the marginalized, the broken. I found out that he took on society and the religious bit. And I really liked him for what he was doing. Yeah, so I did.
Some people talk about religion as a crutch, and you know, for people who really need it. And The story of someone coming out of disadvantage, it being in prison, and then, oh, they've found religion, sounds a little bit kind of predictable. But how would you react to that summation?
Well, I've heard that said before, that, you know, faith is a crutch or Christianity is a crutch. But I had the complete opposite understanding of it. When I became a Christian, I felt God took all my crutches away, actually, and just left me naked, really, to sort of try and sort my act out and depend on him. I mean, I'm a lot of things. I still am. But one thing I'm not is weak. So when all those crutches, you know, drinking, womanizing, debt, all the stuff that were my crutches around me, failed relationships, when all those disappeared, I was left on my own with just me. And that can be quite a sobering thought.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Now, alongside his duties as priest in charge at St. Augustine's in London, the Reverend Paul Cowley is the founder of Caring for Ex-Offenders, a global mentoring and support program for people coming out of prison. Now, they don't just support ex-cons directly, but they train people and groups, including churches, who want to support ex-cons as well. His own short stint in prison is just part of the reason why he's now dedicated his life to this work.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I wasn't in prison for long, but, you know, the work I've been doing for nearly 20 years now, working with these types of people and working in prison and marginalised and the poor, if you want to put a category on them. Yeah, it did. My upbringing has given me an empathy to people who start out, just can't get on that first run for lots of reasons that their fault, but a lot of reasons not their fault.
And what about your faith? What kind of vision does it give you for the person who's coming out of prison?
I think it gives me a hope, Natasha, really, that anyone can change if they want to. You know, that you don't have to be what you were. You don't have to let your past, you know, dictate your future. You don't have to be that type of character. For myself, you know, the Cowley family, the men in a Cowley family of horrendous histories. You know, my grandfather was a bare-knuckle street fighter in Toxteth in Liverpool. My father got put into a home when he was 5. His parents didn't want him. So I became that man. And until I met people and the church and God said, no, you can be different if you want to. So it's that excites me with these men and women who can change.
Paul says that during his stint in prison, there were no rehabilitation programs, none that he was aware of anyway. So these days, things are a little better. Organisations like the one he works for, the William Wilberforce Foundation, go into prisons and they support people as they re-enter the outside world.
So what are the changes that you would like to see, are hoping to see, in that system?
Very good question. What would I like to see? I'd like to see prisons closing down. I'd like to see men not committing crime. I'd like to see families back together. I'd like to see kids taken out of care. I'd like to see men leading, you know, constructive, positive lives in society. I'd like to see more money spent on education while they're in there. I'd like to see more money spent and more organisations involved on working with people with mental health issues. 70% of men and women in prison, mostly men, have some form of mental health issue. So all those things, but it costs money. And it takes a vision, I think, by not only individuals like me, but government to have a long-term view on reducing reoffending.
Let's think about the needs of those people as they come out of prison. There's some obvious ones, but what are some of the less obvious ones? Things like friendship or community, maybe even spiritual needs.
William Booth, who was the founder of the Salvation Army, had this little thing he would say, which was the three S's, soup, soap and salvation. And I think that really sums it up, you know, because he would say it's no use talking to someone about the love of God if their belly's rumbling. You need to feed them. So there's a big issue around food. And doing that. And then he would say, you can't talk to them about the love of God if they're out in the elements freezing. You need to put a roof above their head and clothe them. So there's the practical implications. And when you've done those two things, then you can tell them that God loves them and they might listen to you. So there's lots of issues. There's the addiction issue. There's, you know, it's, I think it's 82% of men, or maybe more, maybe it's up near 99% of men in prison are addicted to some form of drug. And a lot of them weren't addicted when they went in, but become addicted inside. So you've got an addiction problem. You've got children in care when they come out. You've got them coming out with no fixed abode, so nowhere to live. You've got a discharge grant of £45. You've got them carrying their possessions in a bin bag, standing at a bus stop. So you've got all that, and you've got, if they're trying to change, we would tell them as an organisation, you need to cut away all your friends, or your past, or the bad influences, and then they're left with nothing. So you've got to start rebuilding their lives, which is it's a very brave thing to go through when you say you want to change.
What support do you guys give them?
Well, the William Wilberforce Foundation has part of it that's called the Caring for Ex-Offenders work, and what that does, it meets the men and women on release. I stole it unashamedly from William Booth, the Gate Brigade. He'd go around and pick these men and women up when they come out, and I thought, goodness me, we could do that again. So we meet them at the gate. We find churches, communities that want to help these men and women when they're released, and we meet them at the gate. We take them to these communities, and those communities then will start through training and a leadership program within there, an assessment-based analysis of what they do. The church would be trained. And then what they do is they try to help them rebuild their lives together in practical ways, like the booth, finding them a job, finding them accommodation, mentoring them, working out these issues, sending them to organisations that can help them, and start to put it together again.
Now, this is a daunting task. It's not simple or straightforward or quick.
No.
It takes a huge amount of commitment. There'd be some people who would say, would question why you should even do it in the first place. They've done something terrible often. Why should we help these people?
Well, again, UK statistics, I think there's 92 or 95% of the prison population are being released. So they're coming out. And they're coming out to a street, an avenue, a city, a town.
Near you.
Near you. And actually, in the place I live in London is a rather nice area where I live. I'm very fortunate to live there. But I've had my car stolen. Each side of us, the houses have been broken into. One of our neighbours was mugged. I've had three motorbikes stolen. So I want these men and women to
karma,
come out.
This is karma, right?
This is karma, yeah. You can see I'm all right with it now.
You should be very kind to these people.
What I want is these men and women, when they come out, to have changed. I don't want them to go back in for obvious reasons. I want them to find faith. I'm a priest. But practically, I want them to change because it changes society. I don't want my car stolen. I don't want my house. I don't want my neighbour mugged. I want them to live in the community with me, but be constructive when they live there.
What do you think the church and church communities have particularly to offer ex-offenders?
They have amazing things to offer, Natasha. What they can offer is a community of men and women who will help them. If these men and women being released, if they've come to a knowledge of God, if they've got a faith, they're interested in the Christian walk, then the church can help them gather around them, because the church is a massive resource. You know, the Alpha Course I mentioned earlier on, in the UK there's 9,500 churches of every Christian denomination running that, and I think 70,000 churches around the world are involved in that course. And you've got thousands of churches that, once they're trained up, have business men and women in there. They've got doctors, they've got lawyers, they've got nurses, they've got every single need that these men and women want in the church. So they can gather around, and apart from all that, they can be a loving community.
That's not always people's experience of church. You know, do you find that respectable churchgoers are happy to welcome offenders?
I think the church struggles with it sometimes, with all this stuff, and I think it's based on fear. So that's why a while ago I started this, founded this charity called Caring for Ex-Offenders, that I thought, you know, if we're asking the church to take these men and women, then you've got to offer the men and women or the pastors some sort of training. So we train these churches up. And once they're trained, there's absolutely no excuse for not getting involved in this. And not to throw lots of scripture at them, but there's one piece of scripture that's really stuck on my heart since I got involved in that, and it's Matthew 25, where it's our corporal acts of mercy. It's what we're supposed to do as Christians. I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was naked, I was a stranger, I was sick, and I was in prison, and you came to see me. And for the least you did of these people, you did it for me. It's a command. I'm ex-military, so I think God is our commander-in-chief, and he tells us to go and help the poor.
The William Wilberforce Foundation in the UK runs a lot of programs that target the immediate physical needs of ex-offenders, things like providing food and shelter. But they also offer other services like counselling and support to overcome addictions. One of their programs is a night shelter. Homelessness is a big problem. And basically, ex-offenders can drop in any time of night.
And we started that, and one character came in called Eddie. Eddie was from Glasgow. Eddie was abused mentally, physically, sexually by his parents as a young boy. Then he went into the care system. Unfortunately, he was abused in the care system. He ran away. He got involved with crime. Went to prison for over 12, 13 years of his life, then became addicted to alcohol, every sort of drug you could think of. Came down to London because it's paved with gold. Everything's going to be better in London. And it got worse. He collapsed through injecting into his main arteries, was living in a skip at the time, was an alcoholic, every sort of drug you can think of. And then stumbled into one of our night shelters. Small man, very violent, very aggressive when drunk. We'd throw him out, he'd come back, throw him out, he'd come back. Then he started coming into our drop-in, which is a day centre where they can come in and try and sort some of these issues out. He was just as bad in there. And then what happened to him, some volunteers invited him on one of these alpha courses I keep talking about. And he was a real mess, but volunteers in the church, and especially we talked about what can the church do, they invited him and just loved him through the course. Never told him to get a bath, never told him to cut his hair. He was rather smelly, his terrible state he was in. And what happened, he came to faith through that course. Then started wandering in the church that I'm responsible for, one of the sites, because we do the night shelters, so he was familiar with it. And then slowly started to change. And I don't know how long it took, but I saw him one Sunday in a service, and I spotted this man in the congregation. And I went over to him, and I could not believe it was Eddie. He was clean shaven, he'd had his hair cut, he had a lovely denim shirt on, he was well dressed, he smelt brilliant. And what he'd done, the church had loved him. They'd encouraged him to sort himself out in a loving way. Then he went through the recovery course. He's an addict. He's still doing that. He's been clean for 12 years, I think, now. He's working for an organization called Pret a Manger, which is a cafe chain, helping kids excluded from school, talking to them.
He did close to your heart, Paul.
Close to my heart. He did a diploma in theology. He's got a flat. And he texts me every single day. And on this tour, he said, "Paul, tell him what can happen if the church gets involved."
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore. We've been speaking with the Reverend Paul Cowley, founder of Caring for Ex-Offenders, which is part of the William Wilberforce Trust, and he's priest in charge at St. Augustine's Queen's Gate.
He's also an advisor to the British government on issues relating to prisoners and social justice, and was awarded an MBE by the Queen for his services to ex-offenders.
To hear more incredible stories like Paul's, we have plenty on our website, publicchristianity.org, or on our podcast. Just type Life and Faith in the search box of Apple Podcasts or any podcast player to find us.
Just recently, we had a couple of conversations with Amy Orr Ewing. She delivered our Richard Johnson lecture this year, and she shared some pretty fascinating tales from her own life, such as smuggling Bibles to the Taliban, and from the subject of her doctoral thesis, Dorothy L. Sayers. And part two does involve me reading a jingle about a toucan. You kind of have to be there.
One of my favourites so far this year was my conversation with the Corbetts. They're an incredible couple living in Everton in Liverpool. They're like a poverty-fighting, justice-defending superhero duo. They love their community, they champion their community, and they're just great people. There's a story about what to do in the case of a fire when you live on the 14th floor of a tower block, but the fire department's ladder only reaches the 9th. And the story about a kid who draws a picture of an empty plate. It's just heartbreaking. Next week, reconciliation and the 50th anniversary of the 1967 referendum, which delivered big and long overdue changes for Aboriginal people in Australia.